It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. We'll get a preview of tomorrow's debate among candidates for the Republican presidential nomination.
First, Governor Walker and Republican lawmakers say they want to change Wisconsin's elections board by the fall of 2016.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said he'd like to split the Government Accountability Board into two agencies. He also said he wanted to include former lawmakers or other people who represent Democrats and Republicans as part of this new board.
Patrick Marley is with us to talk about this news. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me in.
So why do Republican lawmakers want to overhaul the Government Accountability Board by the year 2016?
Well, they don't think that the Accountability Board has done a good job. It was created 7 years ago, and they think that it is unfair to Republicans, so they want a system that they think is more neutral. Members of the Accountability Board and others dispute their arguments and say that, you know, it is a fair, impartial agency.
Now, the Government Accountability Board, the GAB, was created in the year 2007. At the time, this was an idea that had bipartisan support. Can you tell us about that initial vision for the GAB when it was created?
Sure. Prior to the GAB, we had the State Elections Board and the State Ethics Board. So we had two different agencies. The Elections Board was a partisan agency. So it was appointed by the governor and legislative leaders and political parties. And so they had results that you would typically expect. When Republicans came to with complaints to the board, the Republicans on the board said, these guys are right, the Democrats said they're wrong, and vice versa. This came to a head when we had the caucus scandal where lawmakers and their aides were doing campaign work out of state offices, and the Elections Board and the Ethics Board didn't do anything about that. A lot of criticism came to bear. Eventually, prosecutors got involved and charged members of both parties. And this was a response to that and to create a new system that was supposed to be impartial. They merged their duties into one board, and they put former judges on the board. They also gave them a great deal of secrecy, and they were able to conduct investigations without the public knowing about it. That later led to frustrations as they did this work, and the public couldn't really ascertain what they were up to and, you know, whether they were investigating things that needed to be investigated or whether they were being heavy-handed when they did conduct investigations.
Now, in your piece, you quote a couple of election law experts with national profiles. What do they have to say about how Wisconsin's current Government Accountability Board is seen across the rest of the country?
The people I talked to were Daniel Takagi and Rick Hasen, and they both have very favorable impressions of the GAB. They say this is a national model. The elections, or the GAB, is responsible for administering campaign finance laws, but also for just the day-to-day business of running elections. Virtually everywhere else in the country, those are done by partisan people, either an elections board like we had where it's got a partisan nature to it, or by an elected official like a Secretary of State who's on the ballot with a D or an R behind their name. So they see this as a very positive development to have a body that is supposed to be truly nonpartisan. And one of the things they say is if there are problems with partisanship or there are problems with one party being treated better than another under the system we have, the solution should be, in their view, to make sure that it's truly nonpartisan rather than to directly inject partisanship into that agency.
Now, this move is being advanced by Governor Walker and some in the GOP, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. What do they say about how this new overhauled state elections board could look?
Well, we haven't seen precisely what they want to do, but one thing they're talking about is going back to an agency like we had before. So you'd have, Robin Voss said to me, maybe we'd have former lawmakers on there or others that are appointed specifically with a Democratic and Republican point of view. That way they think that there would be more balance to these kinds of things and that you wouldn't be worried about secret agendas because, you know, everybody would be wearing their party affiliation on their sleeve.
Is there an issue with, as you put it, secret agendas? Is transparency an issue with the current Government Accountability Board?
It is certainly not a very transparent organization, and board members I've spoken to over the years and the board's executive director, Kevin Kennedy, have all said that they think there's too much secrecy and that that's a problem with the way the agency was created. This is something that legislators did. They said that when they wanted this agency created that they needed to operate in secret and that it would be a crime for the board to disclose certain details or talk about investigations except in very narrow circumstances. Now, that has come back to some big criticisms. You know, there's been this John Doe investigation, which was thrown out by the state Supreme Court last month, that looked into whether there were campaign finance improprieties of Governor Walker's campaign. Republicans are very concerned about the way that was conducted. The GAB had a role in it, and we don't know all of the precise details, in part because of these secrecy rules that govern the GAB.
We're talking with Patrick Marley right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about news that Republican lawmakers and the governor want to overhaul the Government Accountability Board that oversees elections by the year 2016. And Kevin Kennedy, director of the current Government Accountability Board, what have you heard from him about how he's responding to these proposed changes?
Well, the thing that he's focused on is the secrecy issue. He thinks that this should be opened up. He feels that the board hasn't acted in a biased manner and that if the public could see all this, they would be more confident of that. So he says that they should loosen the rules. He says everything to do with the John Doe investigation he thinks should be out there so the public can look at it. But he's also cautioning these lawmakers that they shouldn't make changes too quickly, that in the world of elections, if the election for president in next year is a year and a half away, but that in the world of those who run elections is really on our doorstep and that we shouldn't make the changes until after that. There's no sign that Republicans are going to slow down on this. They really want to see these things in place for that fall 2016 election.
Well, in 2016 would be the first presidential election with the state's new voter ID law in place. Is that something that Kevin Kennedy's thinking about?
Yes, he said, we've had this law on the books since 2011, but because of court orders, it wasn't allowed to go into place. It's now in effect, but we've only had very small, scattered elections with it. And so really the next big test of the voter ID law and how it's administered will be in the spring when we have our spring elections. But that's nothing compared to the kind of turnout you get in a presidential election. So that will be the first major election with the photo ID law. And Kennedy says you need continuity heading into that to make sure everything goes without a hitch.
What are other critics saying about overhauling the Government Accountability Board?
Well, they're saying that we need to open it up. We need to make sure that people aren't getting carried away. They're very concerned that the Accountability Board misinterpreted campaign finance laws and considered things that were allowed under the First Amendment to be crimes, and that we need to make sure that stops. So they're, restructuring the GAB is just one part of the fall agenda. They also want to rewrite campaign finance laws, which really haven't been updated since the 1970s. Since then, we've had some pretty major rulings. Citizens United is probably the best known, but there have been a number of other decisions that really have an impact on Wisconsin's campaign finance laws. And they want to make significant changes to the John Doe law, which is the system that allows district attorneys to conduct secret investigations for any number of crimes that they used against the Walker campaign. They want to prevent those from being used in political cases.
Is that part of the move to overhaul the GAB?
It'll be a separate bill, but it's all intertwined because of these concerns that were raised through this John Doe investigations, that's sort of a three-part thing that they're doing, restructuring the GAB, rewriting the campaign finance laws, and changing the John Doe law.
Now, it's very early, obviously, in any process here, but do you see a reversion to the way things used to be with an elections board and an ethics panel?
I think it is a little too early to say for sure. Clearly, they're going to do something. That was the idea that Robin Voss had, the Assembly Speaker. Others I'm hearing in the Senate want to make sure that it's one board, not two. There's some talk of among some of keeping, as I say, the GAB is made up of six former judges. Some want to keep some judges on there and maybe supplement them with people with partisan ties. Others want to kick the judges off the board and put on these new people. So it's definitely a work in progress. They haven't rallied around a specific plan yet, but you know, they're getting closer each day, it appears, and I think by the fall they'll have something that the Republicans who control the legislature can agree on.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk about news that Republican lawmakers want to overhaul the Government Accountability Board by 2016. Fox has released the names of the 10 candidates who will face off in the first Republican presidential debate tomorrow night. Rick Perry is out. John Kasich is in. It's time for a weekly look at the latest in national politics.
Also this week, there have been rumblings of a possible presidential run by Vice President Joe Biden. And this morning, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke to American Jews, telling them not to support the Obama administration's nuclear deal with Iran.
Here with us now is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So, Harry, any surprises in the 10 candidates that made it into the primetime GOP debate tomorrow?
Not really. I mean, we had a pretty good idea heading into the final few days who was leading in the polling averages and who wasn't. The only real surprise was if you had looked at the polls a few weeks back, it didn't seem like John Kasich was going to be able to make it, but he announced very late, I believe it was on July 21st, and was able to use that announcement to get a little bump in the polls, and that was able to slide him into the bottom ring, but just past the point necessary in order to be in the final 10 to be in the debate.
So is this thing now set in stone, or is there any way that the composition could still be changed?
Fox set a deadline of yesterday at 5 p.m. The polls had to be in by that point. The polls are in. It's the 10 that we know it's going to be the 10, unless somebody decides to back out for some reason that we don't know. These are the 10 that are going to be debating tomorrow night on Fox.
And again, run us through how Fox made that decision.
So Fox essentially said, look, we have 17 Republicans running for president, or 17 serious Republicans running for president. We can't have 17 candidates up on a stage. They could have made numerous different ways in which they were going to split it. Remember, there's going to be a 5 p.m. debate that's, I'm calling the junior varsity debate, and then the 9 p.m. debate, the main debate. But the way that they decided to do it was they said, we're going to want to have the quote-unquote serious candidates at 9, and the way they determined who these serious candidates were was they took a 5-poll average, the 5 most recent live interview polls conducted by major organizations, and whoever were the top 10 candidates in that 5-poll average were going to make the debate, and that's exactly where we stand right now.
Do you think people are going to actually watch that first debate, the one you're calling the JV debate?
I know I will. I'm paid to. I have to be honest, I don't think it's exactly a thrilling lineup to hear George Pataki and Jim Gilmore speak, but maybe a few people want to see if Rick Perry can put it together with the glasses on instead of saying oops like he did last time around. But, I mean, that debate is going to be on at 2 p.m. Pacific time. There's just not going to be as many people watching that debate as the later one.
So this is a huge amount of candidates. Have we ever seen a debate with this many candidates debating?
We have never seen 10 people debate as far as I know. Of course, obviously, there could be some Secretary of State race that occurred in Kentucky, you know, in 1979 that had 10 people. But in terms of serious presidential debates, no, we haven't seen 10, not to my knowledge. We did have 8 Democrats on the stage in 2007 leading up to the 2008 debate. And if I could say so, that debate, those first few debates were very wild. They were, you couldn't really pay too much attention because there's only a certain limited amount of time, and to have 10 people try and get in on each point, it's very unwieldy.
Well, exactly. So how do you expect traffic flow to be managed is the first question. And secondly, you've got Donald Trump in there who said, I'm not a debater. Some people are referring to him as a post-policy candidate, so he's a wild card. How do you expect that this is going to go down?
You know, you're going to need a good moderator to be able to pull this off. I think that, you know, a lot of people are going to be tuning in, if only to watch and hear Donald Trump speak. You know, he is this post-politic guy. He is almost a ridiculous candidate in some way and has come from nowhere, at least if you looked at where he was standing a few months ago and now has charted to the top of the Republican polls. I'm not really sure how it's going to go down, but I think that's part of the intrigue and why people want to watch and listen to this, is because it really is an unknown. It could turn out to be an absolute nothing, and we could be all be bored out of our mind, but maybe some fireworks might happen. Maybe someone will go after Trump, or Trump will go after somebody else, and that would be intriguing television to watch.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now at 538, getting the latest in national politics. We're going to take a look at Jeb Bush next. Now, he's taken a bit of heat. Recently, he made some remarks about the funding of women's health care, and he's known as a candidate. He bills himself as a candidate who will answer questions, who doesn't always have to be exactly on script. So tell us what happened with this event.
Well, essentially, you know, if you've been following this controversy with Planned Parenthood and whether or not they were selling certain parts of aborted fetuses, Planned Parenthood is not very popular in Republican circles right now. And essentially, Bush is thought of as this wonk candidate who isn't going to make general statements but is going to make specific statements. And that actually really hurt him in this situation, because instead of saying, I don't believe we should be funding Planned Parenthood, he gave a very specific dollar amount. I believe it was $500 million. I don't believe, you know, we should be spending that much money on women's health issues. And as soon as he said that, you could just hear cries of happiness in Democratic circles, because they know if Jeb Bush ever makes it to a general election, they're going to play that clip over and over again, because they'll say, wait a minute, you're spending too little on women's health issues. You should be spending more. And to put a specific dollar amount on it wasn't very smart of him.
So was that a gaffe, do you think?
I think it was in some ways a gaffe. If you believe, you know, gaffes are situations in which you say things that you honestly believe but you shouldn't be saying. And I honestly think that Jeb Bush probably thinks that, you know, he's a fiscal conservative going back a long time. He probably believes that we do spend too much money for the on the federal government on women's health issues. I don't know that to be sure, but he's the one who made the statement, and it certainly has been picked up by Democrats who are certainly going to run with that if Jeb Bush is the nominee.
And also interesting is that Hillary Clinton jumped on that, responded on Twitter, said something like, you're absolutely wrong on this. Do you expect to see a lot of back and forth volleying from candidates happening on Twitter this time around? Twitter is more prominent than it was even 4 years ago.
I think it's a great way to get your message out very, very quickly. And if you're delayed on Twitter, then you're delayed in the real world. This is no longer a country that relies solely on television and radio in order to get its political news. And people are getting their political news on Twitter, and they're getting their political news on Facebook. And in order to be able to be a candidate of the 21st century, you need to do this. So, yes, I do expect that candidates are going to be responding very quickly on Twitter. That doesn't mean their tweets won't be vetted by their staff, but it does mean that they'll be responding relatively quickly on Twitter.
Okay, so you mentioned Hillary Clinton. She may have someone else to worry about in the wings, maybe not. Vice President Joe Biden is considered a maybe in the presidential race. What do we know about whether he will or will not run?
I think most of the smart money is that he won't run. Joe Biden is what we could call the break glass in case of candidate. If something went very wrong with Hillary Clinton's campaign, maybe, you know, a scandal comes up that we weren't expecting, or maybe there's a health issue, or for some reason just the campaign falls apart. Biden is someone who is well-respected in Democratic establishment circles, someone who could appeal to all different parts of the party. But look, Joe Biden is somebody who is somehow older than Hillary Clinton is, and Hillary Clinton is thought of by, you know, most people as right at the upper edge of where you would want to be if you're running for president. He's a white male in a party that's increasingly non-white, and it just really isn't there if you think about it, if he's going to try and run and be the anti-Hillary. If you look at the polls, he basically takes votes from everybody when he's mentioned in a horse race question. He doesn't have a specific base. He's only really going to run if Hillary Clinton falters.
And what about reports that Joe Biden considered stepping down after his son passed away? And during that time, his son said he should take another run at the presidency. Do you think that kind of, if it's, whether it's true or not, we don't know. It's been reported. But will that have an influence?
I mean, look, as a person who loves his father very dearly, I don't have a son. But, you know, if my father said something to me, or I know if I said something to my dad, of course it would have some sort of an appeal. But I think Biden, at the end of the day, is a politician. He is going to look at the landscape that's around him and recognize it for what it is. Hillary Clinton is the strongest non-incumbent running in the modern era for the presidency of the United States. She has almost all the endorsements that have been given out by Democratic politicians. I think Martin O'Malley has one congressman. Clinton has the majority of Democratic senators, Biden's former body. It just isn't there unless something happens that currently isn't happening in the Democratic primary.
Now, we're going to wrap up talking about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking this morning to American Jews via webcast, urging them to oppose the nuclear deal with Iran from the White House. What do you make of that kind of lobbying of the American public by a foreign leader?
It tells you that he's very serious about this issue. I think that most people think that, you know, foreign politicians shouldn't be delving into domestic politics in the same way that you wouldn't expect, you know, a Republican to critique President Obama when they're overseas. You usually just don't see this type of thing. So it's very clear that Netanyahu and the Israeli public at large is very much against this deal, and he is trying to ensure that they get as many votes as possible. And look, there are a lot of Democrats that are sort of on the fence here, especially a lot of pro-Israeli Democrats, and he's trying to ensure that they vote against this. But even if they do, it seems right now that there just are not enough Democratic politicians that are going to be against this deal in order to assure that there's a veto-proof majority in order to stop it. And so we're going back and forth here, and you can even see this with the Democratic politicians like Barbara Boxer, Sandra Levin, these Jewish Democrats who are for the deal. And if you aren't going to get them, you're probably not going to be able to pull it off.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time for the latest in national politics.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Last week on Central Time, we heard about a survey that found that people in the area stretching from Milwaukee to Gary, Indiana, would be open to coordinating some government services to act in a way as a super city.
But how would something like that play out in practice? We'll key in on one possible area for cooperation, transportation. Two pieces lately in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel tackle that issue. Coming up, we'll hear from a guest who says one good starting point would be a boost to the Hiawatha Amtrak passenger line, bringing together Milwaukee and Chicago.
Before that, our next guest writes there's a lot of room for cooperation on transportation planning in the Milwaukee region, from the city and its suburbs down into northern Illinois. He says a coordinated effort could bring a big economic boost to the area.
Tom Rave joins us now. He's the recently retired executive director of the Gateway to Milwaukee and of Aerotropolis Milwaukee. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob.
So let's start with what's at stake here. How important is transportation infrastructure to getting businesses to settle and set up shop in a region?
It's very important, especially for manufacturers, which this region has decided to emphasize. If you think about it, manufacturing involves getting materials, moving material physically somehow to a location, doing your manufacturing, and then somehow transporting the product elsewhere, hopefully through exporting. So clearly, transportation costs and activities are critical to those kinds of businesses making money.
And in your piece, you point out also getting employees to that work site is part of the picture, too.
Correct. In the situation with the city of Milwaukee, there are many people who, for one reason or another, or would like to get a job or would want to get a job, but getting to a job is a problem for them. Often the manufacturers may be located in suburbs, and the transit system does not adequately serve the whole region right now, especially if it crosses county lines, because, as it turns out, most counties have their own transit systems, which is really a very inefficient approach and costly approach to serving the needs of the people.
Right. In the region you're talking about, the Milwaukee area, the region surrounding it, there are a lot of local and county governments, as you mentioned. Beyond that, to those transit systems, how does that affect transportation planning?
It affects it. The Milwaukee area has Southeast Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, which does a lot of work of that kind of planning. Most of it focuses on transit. However, in the case of Milwaukee, there is an airport. There is the Port of Milwaukee. There are railroads that go through it, and there used to be what is called an intermodal ramp, which is able to load and unload large containers that go in container ships across the seas. About 3 years ago, that facility was closed by the Canadian Pacific, so Southeast Wisconsin does not have that transportation capability right now. And the way things are organized is that Milwaukee County owns the airport and City of Milwaukee owns the Port of Milwaukee. Both of those entities operate on a financial standalone basis, and in fact, by regulation, Milwaukee County cannot, for example, make a payment to Milwaukee County. Nonetheless, how decisions get made are within the government structure that is just really surrounded by the lines of the entity itself, be it the city lines or the county lines. yet the market that is served by both these entities is far larger. So the whole approach is to how you serve a market of businesses and people, which in the case of the airport and for intermodal ramp capabilities is really the southeastern one-third of the whole state of Wisconsin. So it's really an organization structure problem as to how you best deliver these services and do it efficiently, because our geographic location is really something of a handicap versus the south end of Lake Michigan, which is a more efficient location for major transportation to occur.
Right, and before we get to solutions, Tom, is this all, this divided transportation picture, a drag on the economy of the region compared to other similar metropolitan areas and their hinterlands?
In some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. There are the best example, as I learned about this, even goes back to the 1950s when the Toledo-Lucas County, and this is at the west end of Lake Erie, they formed their own transportation authority, basically. And the state legislature in Ohio did that in the 1950s. And that entity actually owns the Port of Toledo, an airport, a bus station, a railroad station, and real estate around those areas, so it can act as one unit in going to try to do those services. This exists in many other places across the country. Probably the biggest one is the New York, New Jersey Port Authority, which if you go on the website and look at that, covers all kinds of transportation capabilities that's done just by one entity. The same thing happens in Seattle, where the Port of Seattle and SeaTac Airport are owned and operated by the same entity. So when you come to having businesses stay in your area, and this is a competitive situation across the country, those areas clearly have a strategic advantage that we don't have.
We're talking to Tom Rave about a piece he recently wrote in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel calling for more coordination on transportation in southeastern Wisconsin and really beyond, even into northern Illinois. So let's get to what that would look like, Tom. What would you like to see happen? What kind of authority needs to be there, do you think, to coordinate transportation efforts?
Well, it needs to be a government authority because a source of funding for any such authority, the principal source is going to be the federal government. And in order to qualify for such type of an entity, you need to be a government entity. But how do you avoid being close to the political environment that exists? And when you start talking about dollars for transportation, these are significant amounts of money, and the investments are for long periods of time. So you could have a structure in place where the board of directors or commissioners or whatever, in Southeast Wisconsin's case, would come from at least six counties. And they would be people who have economic development experience or transportation experience. And you would organize a structure, and this is not unlike, say, some corporate structure, for example, where at the very top level you could have your administration, finance, human resources, accounting, all these types of common functions for an organization, be it a government organization or a business organization. And then the operating entities, be it the Port of Milwaukee, be it transit, be it the airport, be it a part of the organization that is in position to work with railroads, and railroads are important for both freight and for transit, you have people really specialize in doing that. The marketing overall, again, is for people who are looking at businesses across broader areas and for groups of people and really doing much more market analysis about how freight is moved, what's the timing, what are the economics, where does it have to go, and the same thing for moving people. So that could be a board of directors. You would have Wisconsin Department of Transportation, Southeast Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, would be non-voting members of the board. You need that kind of input and activity, but you don't want to have them be in position to start voting on what happens. You can use their services, and obviously you need to interface with WISDOT, but you can structure this so it really serves the needs of the region, and it wouldn't be done necessarily by elected officials. So it wouldn't be held so much sway to the particular party, organization, or thoughts that are in place. So it could be run much more, I guess I would say, on a more business-like fashion, looking at the services that need to be provided, doing it so you get a return.
Suppose I'm. Suppose this does happen, Tom. What would I, as a business owner or a consumer, a commuter, see happening differently in my transportation options if this went into place?
Well, you can, I think, structure things differently where you essentially get information from the marketplace differently than goes on now. And this kind of an approach is done in Indiana. There's an organization called Conexus, which is spelled capital C-O-N-E-X-U-S, which, again, can be seen on a website, that is set up to enhance manufacturing across the whole state of Indiana. And it's organized according to the Regional Planning Commission structure that takes place in states, and that, which is a requirement of the federal government. But they do research, and they are the organization is actually funded by over 50 manufacturers now to do this. So the organization, they get information from manufacturers about their freight needs and their transit needs, and then this is accumulated over a period of time. It's affiliated with Ball State University, and that information then is provided quarterly to the state legislature. So it kind of acts like a buffer in some ways between the actual market and the state legislature, but it gives direct information to the state legislature as to how money should be spent by the state of Indiana on transportation needs. It also has the data so it can work with the federal government, and when the federal government is trying to decide where it will spend its transportation dollars, you have good data, you have ready market information, so you can compete among other areas across the country trying to get money from the federal government. So those are the types of things that could be done that just are not being done now.
And Tom, briefly, if I'm in a local government, a county or a city government, in effect, I'm giving up some authority to this regional authority, whatever we end up calling it. How do you make the case to me in that instance that that giving up that authority is going to pay off for me?
I think I would start by, well, tell me how things are going now. And is there a better way? Are you satisfied with the performance of your transportation capabilities now? Look what's going on elsewhere. Is there a better way to do that? And, in fact, are your own employees, do they have the capabilities to really have the information, and will they be able to deliver things on a competitive basis so the whole region gets served? Let me give you a quick story, Rob. I had a breakfast with a person who happens to live in Brookfield as I do. He is still a chairperson of a manufacturer that publicly held company. He's retired as a CEO, and we were talking about these concepts. And he said, you know, Tom, he said, as the work we did, we looked at where else we would like to have manufacturing locations, where we would like to operate. He said, if we weren't here in Milwaukee, if we were looking somewhere else, we would never consider operating or locating north of Chicago. So just think about the impact of that. You've got to be able to perform more efficiently to attract businesses to locate here in the future. It's just that simple.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Tom Rave, recently retired executive director of the Gateway to Milwaukee and of Aerotropolis Milwaukee. We continue our look now at regional transportation in the Milwaukee area. Our next guest says one big part of the puzzle is Amtrak's Hiawatha line connecting Milwaukee and Chicago. He joins us to make the case for increasing and improving that service.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used the Hiawatha line or any other passenger rail here in Wisconsin? Do you rely on it for work or travel? What do you like and where do you see room maybe for improvement? If you don't have access to passenger rail and you're part of the state, do you wish you did? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
David Haynes joins us now. He's the editorial page editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob and Veronica. Great to be with you.
So you wrote, David, in a recent piece that the idea of regional coordination, maybe as far as Milwaukee to Gary, Indiana, could be a tall order for now, but focusing in on the Hiawatha line in particular would be a good place to start. Why is that?
Well, I think that you kind of start with what works. The column I wrote last week grew out of a conference that Marquette Law School did, actually the second of two conferences it did, on this idea of the Chicago megacity, the idea that this concept that Chicagoland and Milwaukee really are linked as one entity. And I think there's something to that, and I think there are some economic benefits to the region by closer ties with Chicago. And one real obvious way is by improving the Hiawatha service. You know, look, we have 7 trains a day right now. Those trains are seeing increased ridership. We've gone from roughly 10 years ago, 470,000 riders a year to well over 800,000 riders a year. The 7 trains a day, some of those trains are full or over capacity. And there has been in the past bipartisan support for the Hiawatha. It's not like the high-speed rail line that Governor Scott Walker was so strongly opposed to and other Republicans. Walker actually has supported the Hiawatha in the past.
What kind of benefits do you see Milwaukee and the region getting from being that connected via rail with Chicago?
Well, I think one of the main benefits is if you could improve service, and this was talked about back around the time of the high-speed train to Madison, that whole debate, about improving service from about an hour and a half each way to an hour, it would make it easier for people to live in between and get the jobs in either Chicago or Milwaukee. In fact, people do this already. People who live in Milwaukee actually commute down to the Loop every day. A lot of people who work at Miller Coors do that. That would be a lot more doable if it's only an hour's ride. And that was something that was talked about at the time. There was, in fact, some money in the $800 million that the governor turned back to the federal government for improving the Hiawatha line. They later went back to the federal DOT to ask for some of that money. I think it was about $150 million. And DOT said, no, that's not really part of the package. But I think we're far enough away from it now that you could make another run at that. And so I think there are economic benefits, and there's also benefits to the entire transportation system if more people are riding the train. If you get cars off the road and the train takes cars off the road, that relieves congestion and means that goods and services can flow better through the transportation system.
Talking to David Haynes from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about transportation in the Milwaukee area specifically, he says, hey, time to improve the Hiawatha line. Got a lot of riders, strong connection between Milwaukee and Chicago. Economic benefits to improving it. You can share your thoughts on passenger rail here in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So one improvement you mentioned, David, improvements to make it a little faster to get back and forth. What other kind of service changes do you think could help?
Well, you certainly could add trains potentially, and there might be a market for that, and again, the market ought to dictate that. But when you have 7 trains a day and 3 or 4 of them are full, especially at peak times, then there might be a market for another train. There might be a market for another train on weekends, again, depending on what that traffic looks like. I actually think the time of the commute is really key. It's an hour and a half now, which isn't bad, but I think it would make a difference if you could get that to near high-speed service, so about 100 miles an hour service, and get you down there in about an hour. You know, there's been talk in the past about expanding the Metro, Chicago Metro service, which now ends at Kenosha up to Milwaukee. That was in Wisconsin that had the name KRM, Kenosha, Racine, Milwaukee. I don't think that's really politically feasible now at this point, although I happen to think it might be a good idea. I think it's a different market. But I think that there's enough interest in the Hiawatha and of bipartisan interest that it might be worth a shot now to do that.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I got to tell you, I love to take the train, and we've, as a family, taken it several times on trips. I guess my biggest question would be is why not have more of a fast train between major metropolitan areas and truly make it an alternative to plane flights? It's the frequent stops that often make the trip seem so long and prevent them from really gaining a high speed to make it a real competitor with airplane travel.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Would that be a viable option, do you think, David, to have, I guess, an express train straight from Milwaukee to Union Station in Chicago?
Well, sure, and I think that should be part of the plan. You know, this corridor works because we're close. if you're talking about linking, say Milwaukee and St. Louis, or even Chicago and St. Louis with high-speed rail, it's just farther away. I'm not sure it works as well. But this corridor has a tradition of rail traffic. It has a lot of interest from the public. In the market study, they did a poll on different issues related to the megacity that was just released last week. And one of the findings, which I found really interesting, is that even though only 11% of the people in the entire 21-county area, that includes Chicago and Indiana, use rail to commute, more than 30%, or around 30%, in each state, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Indiana, said they would rather put more money into rail service than into roads. And in Wisconsin, we have a real tradition over the past 30 years or so of pouring a lot of money into roads, but not so much into other forms of transportation. So, in my opinion, I think it might be time for a more balanced approach.
Time for one more quick call from Ryan in Waukesha. Ryan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I think there's a great economic benefit. I agree with what you've been saying here to development and working with the Chicago metro area and including Milwaukee as a piece of that. But also the corridor that includes this the Hiawatha is General Mitchell Field. And I think that that's a great alternative to a lot of northern Chicago people already, and it could be developed even more so.
Ryan, thanks a lot. We'll give you the last word. David Haynes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet.
That's David Haynes, editorial page editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A 2005 Gallup survey is circling back into the media to heat up the debate. What are the best months of the year, and what are the worst?
The worst ones are probably unsurprising for anyone who lives in Wisconsin. January and February came in dead last. I got to agree with that, although you, Rob, you get a little crazier off the chart a little with your answer to that question. You said March. How come?
So January and February, bad weather. Sure, it can get cold, snowy, but the January and February, you expect that. March is the month that beats your expectations. It defeats you. It gets your hopes up and then crushes them again and again. So I got to put March at the bottom of at number 12.
Except when it's kind of nice and you get early spring.
Right. And then, but you know, tomorrow will be different. The freezing rain returns. So, okay, best months though. May, right? People put May at the top of their list. Then October, which I think I would probably put at number one. Then June is in third place in this poll. You?
Well, June is my birthday month. I'm biased toward
it is.
June.
I had no idea. Kidding.
You should. There's only 325 more
shopping days. Yeah.
But yeah, I think that early fall is so beautiful
right.
in Wisconsin. Yeah, definitely. I have to go along with that one.
And it's a national poll. So I think probably, and this didn't break it down by state. I'm guessing if you're in humid, you know, Washington, D.C. area, August has got to be at the bottom of the list. It's, I don't know. I'm not a huge August fan. I'm liking it so far here.
I think August
month,
is great.
I mean.
You get those late summer bugs. I'm a big August fan.
The mosquitoes?
No, they're mostly gone by August.
Huh. Not in my backyard. Hey, stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.